We're hearing the news today about the this, former member of this community, Aloka. He was a bhikkhu who was ordained here at Amaravati, I believe, about 15, 16 years ago, and left the Sangha 6 or 7 years ago. And the news that he took his own life last week, it brings a lot of sad feelings and sobering reflections to mind. In particular, how we've gathered together for this 3-month period, engaged in our winter retreat time, and looking directly at the mind and its workings. And we can see how the mind is both the greatest blessing, the greatest friend, and also the worst enemy, the most difficult and challenging presences. I don't know any of the circumstances behind Aloka's decision and the situation he was in. I can't make any presumptions, but being aware of other people who've taken their own lives or attempted that, it's good to reflect on how the mind can get into such dark or hopeless states that the only way out seems to be to try and to switch everything off, to disconnect from life itself. It's easy to be ready to explain everything or to give glib or good sort of well worked out theoretical answers, but obviously when someone is in such a state of distress and despair that they take their own life, it's not a easy rational or clear rational explanations don't always apply. It's not always a clear cut or rational thing. My own cousin took her own life. She was apparently in a very good marriage. Her husband was very, very loving, and had no idea that she was in a state of distress. They were quite a kind of colourful couple. Did some fairly serious drinking together. But they're a very, very good-humoured, high-spirited, loving couple. And he was a glazier. He used to work with glass. And went out to work one morning and had realised he'd forgotten some of his tools. And so turned his van around, came home and found that his wife, my cousin Sue, had committed suicide. Just sort of said goodbye after breakfast, gone off to work. No sign that anything was amiss, and then suddenly, she's gone. Probably many of us, if not all of us, have had some kind of contact with this kind of distress that people in our families or friends, people we've lived with, grown up with, have been significant in our lives have had to deal with. So it's difficult to put yourself into the shoes of others and to know exactly the details of a situation. But we can look at our own minds and we can see how the mind can absorb into very negative, depressive states, feelings of, in particular, of hopelessness, feelings of There's no way forward. There's nothing that's workable about my life, about this situation. There's no more options that can be taken. So there's feelings of despair. You know, in the Pali renderings of mind states, domanasa, as a painful mental states, as a, the all-encompassing term that refers to these, say, painful and destructive mind states, painful mental feeling, domanasa. So it's very significant, though, that within Buddhist practice, that those kind of difficult states are, say, addressed and are seen as things that we can indeed work with. Predictably, nowadays, there's even a Buddhist meditation site, a website for working with Buddhist meditation, working with depression. It's called domanasa.org. The kind of modern day resources people have. But I feel it's also one of the great strengths, one of the great blessings that we have in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddhist teachings, practices, how meditation does offer us the tools, and the Buddha's teachings offer us frameworks for understanding the mind and its workings, no matter how difficult or painful, intense or heavy mind states might be, no matter how crazy or weird or intensely blissful. You can have trouble with blissful and expansive mind states as well. But the teachings give us some very helpful guidelines, helpful ways and means of working with even those most challenging or difficult states. Because I find myself over and over and over again, I give a lot of advice to people. You know, I'm sitting there in the sala with sort of the kind of the doctor is in the label in front of my cushion. People can come up and ask questions, and they do very, very often. So I find myself giving a very large amount of advice here. And so often, the issues that people face revolve around believing in the contents of our thoughts, believing what the mind is saying. Whether it's a family conflict, someone having a distressing, say, fight with their spouse, and you know, how what I said, and what she said, and how she should be, and what I want it to be like, and what it should be like, and so it can be to do with a family argument. It can be with why did my child die when they were so young, or why have I got this fatal disease? I'm only 50 years old. Stress with work situations, stress in the monastery situations. It's not always lay people coming to ask questions. And so often, the central issue is believing that what our mind says is true. That taking the thoughts that pass through the mind as an accurate and reliable representation of truth. That's such a core issue. Believing, so when the mind, and even just yesterday, I was having exactly this conversation with someone, when the mind is saying, "I'm not making, I'm not getting anywhere." You know, my efforts at practice, meditation practice, are hopeless. Yeah, I'm not getting anywhere. Then to be able to recognize that's a mind creating a thought. That's the my efforts are hopeless thought. It's a thought. it doesn't have to be true. You know, it's a thought. But the thought is saying it's all hopeless. But it doesn't mean to say it is hopeless at all. It just means that the thought is saying that. That's all. So yesterday I was having exactly this kind of conversation. It's a kind of revelation for a person that, oh my goodness, you can see that just even for a moment the light breaks through and they realize, oh yeah, I do believe it all the time. I tell myself it's hopeless and that I'm not getting anywhere. My mind is chattering all the time. My mind just won't stop. But I say that to myself, but that's just a thought saying my mind never stops. Or I've been practicing for decades, my efforts are hopeless. We take those thoughts to be absolutely true. If we take a step back and consider, well, why should they be true? Just because our mind says it, it doesn't mean it's true. It's just a thought the mind is creating. I remember being introduced to this as a principle literally the first few weeks I was in the monastery, our opinions, our judgments change all the time. That approach, that way of seeing the mind, had never occurred to me. I just had spent a lifetime assuming that if I think it, it's true. And even if what I think this month is different from what I thought last month, I was right then and I'm right now. And if it changes again next month, I'll still be right. Because I'm thinking it, therefore it's the truth. And then taking a step back from that and looking at it, well, wait a minute. If I thought something completely different 5 years ago, and I see, well, that was, I see things differently now. Well, either this is right or that's right. They can't both be right. And if that has changed that much in these few years, then in 5 years' time, how will it seem? So one of the great blessings, the great strengths of Buddhist practice is the ability it gives the mind to not believe in its own contents. It helps the mind to not believe in the words that our thoughts are saying. It doesn't have to take our emotions, our thoughts, our feelings as ultimate realities. This is a simple principle, but extraordinarily potent, significant. Last year, I was saying how I discovered that modern-day meditation approach called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, MBCT. It was a method of meditation and mind training established by a group of three researchers, John Teasdale, Zindel Siegel, and Mark Williams. And it was a particularly effective way of dealing with depression. The effect of depression on mental well-being and the kind of incurable quality of depression was something that people had been, doctors and therapists, psychiatrists had been trying to deal with for decades and decades, ever since the modern era, people working with depression in the modern times since the beginning of the 20th century. They found that if someone had a recurrent episode of depression, if it came back, if it wasn't just a single isolated incident of a few weeks or months that then didn't recur, but if it was something that repeated, no method of treatment had better than a 10% cure rate. So it didn't matter whether it was psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, surgery, electroshock treatment, medication, and there was no treatment for recurrent depression that had more than a 10% cure rate. 90% of people never recovered. And then these three researchers, Zindel, Siegel, and John Teasdale, Mark Williams, developed this method based around Buddhist meditation called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. They ran a study in this country. This was in 2007. This is why mindfulness is sort of everywhere nowadays, because they ran a project in this country, and they showed a 50% cure rate. And so people thought, this is crazy, this is impossible, you're like 500% better than any other treatment in the last 100 years. This is, you've got to be fixing the numbers, or you've done something wrong. It can't be that successful. This is five times as successful as any other treatment ever, of any kind. And so they ran the study again. They did the first study here in the UK, and then did a second study with a completely different group of patients in the USA, and they got exactly the same results. That's when the interest in mindfulness kind of started escalating, because this was an amazing result in terms of medical treatment, that there was something was so effective. And there's more work days lost to depression than any other kind of medical condition around the world, globally. More work days per year are lost for people experiencing depression than any kind of injury or other illness. So it has a huge economic impact as well. So I'd come across that and meeting people in this the field of neuroscience and teaching mindfulness and so on. And then I was at an event with a researcher called Dr. Joanna Cook. And she was she told the story that where that method came from, or how that got MBCT got developed, was John Teasdale listening to a Dhamma talk of Ajahn Sumedho at Oxford University Buddhist Society. And what had been the sort of bing kind of illuminating moment for John Teasdale was the theme that Lumpur Sumedho was putting across in his talk, was that our thoughts are not true, and they're not ours. So the two principles, that the thoughts are not really anything that are owned by us. They're not who and what we are. They don't belong to us, and what they say is not true. And so John then took those two principles tried to figure out ways to use training system of mindfulness-based stress reduction, together with those two principles, to work with depression. So when the mind can have just even a little bit of leverage to relate to thought in a different way, those thoughts that are saying, like Ajahn Viradhamma would call it the I'm no good mantra. Yeah, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good. That little amount of leverage, that little amount of ability to work with those thoughts, to get perspective on them, to say, well, just because the mind says I'm no good, it doesn't mean it's true. And these thoughts really don't have an owner. They're just mind objects that are perceived. So when dealing with those dark, oppressive, intense states, then just that ability to reflect on the content of thought and the feeling of ownership that our thoughts are ours, that they are who and what we are, they belong to us, it's my mind. Just to change the view, to shift the view, the way that the mind holds those, can make an enormous difference. And so that that tool that we have in terms of meditation, it can be tremendously powerful if we apply it. But like any kind of tool, if you don't pick it up and use it and apply it, it doesn't do any good. If the saw just hangs on a peg on the wall, it's no good for cutting wood. The wood is going to remain uncut if the saw still hangs on the peg. You've got to take the saw off the peg on the wall and apply it to the wood in the right way, and then the wood can be cut. So in working with oppressive or negative destructive mind states, then it does take a degree of application. It's not just believing in the principle, but it's a moment by moment application and reflection on the nature of the thought, being mindful of the thinking habits and getting to know them, to understand them, and changing the view of them, changing the perception. Incidentally, Lumpo Zomedo wasn't even aware. He didn't know about this until I told him. He didn't realize that he was so heavily involved in the mindfulness movement. I guess John Teasdale had never written to him and said, "Thank you very much, Lumpo." Maybe he had. I don't think he did that. So. But he was very pleasantly surprised to find out he had is having such a part to play. As I say, it's easy to talk about these things, to put them into words, but when someone's experiencing intensely negative mind states, it's not so easy. Sometimes the words just are off in the distance, and there's this intensity of negativity in the inner world that no amount of good advice can penetrate. There's a very fine little book by William Styron, who's a novelist who wrote Sophie's Choice, called Darkness Visible, and it's about his own depression. And it's a short book, and it's talking about his own experience of depression. And he'd been a steady alcoholic drinker for many, many years, and he'd just gone sober, and he describes how his mind had got into very dark and depressive states. And he just was given this prestigious award by the French Academy, a kind of high-profile award for literature that was very, very rarely given to anyone who wasn't French. And so it was extremely prestigious, and it was... He was being flown to Paris especially to get this award, and he's describing how, even though everyone's congratulating him and all these sort of glittering prizes being put into his hands, his own inner state was this deep misery and feelings of worthlessness and meaninglessness. And the contrast between sort of being up on the stage and being praised and applauded, and his inner kind of grim, miserable state was very, very touching. He's also a very good writer, so he takes you into the experience quite fully. But one of the things that that really struck me in reading that little book, he said, it's so ironic that we talk about this state, depression, like a sort of like a dent in the road, like a little sort of a depression, meaning like a shallow dent in the pathway or the ground. He said, it's talked about in terms of an absence of positivity, or a very inactive state. And people look at you, so sitting in an armchair for 5 hours, and they feel that you're really inert. So the only reason that I sit in a chair for 5 hours without moving is because there's this storm, this raging storm of intense negativity going on inside, so that I'm sort of holding my body steady while this whole raging tumult is going on within. So it's not a kind of a little dent in the ground, or it's not an inert or blank state, but rather one that was sort of one of intensity. So I appreciate that these words can only reach in so far, but they can have an effect. And those of us who are gathered here on the half moon night, gathered for the observance day here, Amravati, joining together for this winter retreat time, that even if we do experience some of these kind of intense or difficult negative mind states, we also have the capacity and also the support system, the Kalyanamitta, the system of friendship and community that can help us to hear these words and help us to be encouraged to use these kind of tools to recognize that we do have ways and means to work with even the most intense, difficult mind states. We're not alone. We're not without help. We're not without resources. And this is one of the great blessings of Sangha, the great blessings of community, that no matter how difficult things might be for the individual, then the group can be there. Others, spiritual friends, can be there to help back us up, and we have supportive resources to hand if we remember to apply them. Oh, in speaking about difficult or negative mind states, and reflecting on the Dhammacakka Sutta we were chanting this evening, one of the main themes of Lumpur Samato's teachings over the years is how when we are trying to apply meditation, or we're using Buddhist principles to work with the mind, that it's very easy to mistake what we're calling letting go for what is actually the desire to get rid of, vibhava tanha, the desire to annihilate. So we give it the label, letting go, like I'm letting go of my negative thoughts, I'm letting go of my greed, hatred, delusion, I'm letting go of my jealousy and lust and fear, and letting go of my agitated thinking. So it's, we label it, or we sort of put that sticker on the bottle. Kind of. This is what we're calling it. But the actuality of what we can be doing within is, get out of here, you don't belong, shut up, go away, be quiet. It's an annihilationist attitude, trying to wipe out our thoughts, trying to wipe out our negative emotions, trying to wipe out our chattering inner voice. And I found that extraordinarily helpful over the years, how Lumpur Samato would point to this quality of vibhava tanha, to see how when we're reading Dhamma books or hearing talks and we can mishandle that principle of letting go, and instead put a lot of effort and energy in trying to destroy our defilements, destroy the negative and dark aspects of our mind, destroy our self-hatred. But Lumpur Samato would always point out is that if the means of working with the mind is that kind of vibhava tanha, that desire to get rid of, then that necessarily leads to more suffering, more dukkha, like in the Dhammacakka Sutta, there's three kinds of craving. The craving for sense pleasure, kama tanha, bhava tanha, the craving to be, the craving for existence, the craving to become, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha, the craving to not be, to stop existing, to not feel. So that when we speak about letting go, then it's important to be clear about the difference between letting go of something and getting rid of, or, you know, that urge to wipe out or to not feel. I think for many people that vibhava dhana, the kind of self-destructive urge, comes from just wanting to not feel, just wanting to shut it up, to stop feeling. And certainly when I was, before I was a monk, I was a heavy drinker. And when I was younger, in my early teens, so 15, 16, then, you know, the partying and drinking was all good fun, and it was there was a sense of enjoyment and sort of delight in it. But by the time I got to 19, 20, heading towards 21, I began to see that I was just drinking to stop feeling, just drinking to switch it off, to be numb, to not be, essentially, to forget, to check out. And we find different ways of doing that, different ways of switching off or not feeling. I mean, in monasteries, we don't have any alcohol, but we have other ways of switching off. Dullness in meditation is a kind of legally appropriate annihilationist tool. To go into meditation, shut your eyes, and just switch off to stop feeling. Oftentimes, when one has a lot of trouble with sleepiness in meditation, the issue is not physical tiredness. The issue is often just negativity. Just the mind is so full of discomfort and painful mind states that it just switches off. It just goes to sleep. It just goes numb in order not to feel those negative states. I'm not analyzing everybody's sleepiness habits in meditation, but it is often the case if you explore that the issue is not. It's not physical tiredness. The issue is often self-hatred. And that the cure for dinamita, sloth and torpor, can often be developing more loving-kindness, more acceptance, more compassion for yourself. That has a strange way of helping to relieve those dull and sleepy tendencies. So we develop different ways of switching off or checking out or just putting our attention somewhere else. But that doesn't end suffering. It avoids dukkha. It doesn't end dukkha. It really just amplifies it. It increases it, really, in my experience. I've been on a lot of trying to avoid dukkha over the years. That kind of approach, or whether it's conscious or unconscious, it just increases the causes of distress and dissatisfaction in the heart. So when we speak about letting go, it's not a desire to get rid of. It's a recognition that essentially it's an insight into anatta. It's a recognition that this thing doesn't really have an owner anyway. So in a sense, the word letting go is not quite accurate, because it's more recognizing that this particular state, it can't be held. It can't be kept. It doesn't have an owner. It doesn't belong to anyone. There isn't really a person here who can own it. So it's rather like letting go of the wind or letting go of the moonlight. You know, you go, well, yeah, it's not really yours in the first place. Letting go of the colors of the dawn or the shining of the evening star. You can let go. Well, yeah, it's not my possession to have in the first place. So when we're talking about the light of the evening star or the wind, then it's kind of easier to establish an attitude of non-possessiveness, not non-owning. But when it comes to mind states and thoughts, memories, ideas, passions, it's harder to do. But the same principle, I would suggest, really, really applies. So that letting go is a recognition of non-ownership. Like this couldn't be owned in the first place. This couldn't be held. It couldn't be possessed in the first place. So it's, in a sense, a waking up of the heart to that quality of non-owning, non-ownership. It sounds a little bit vague, perhaps, but I think if you look at the things that you assume to be yours, like if I look at my body and think this is my body, this is Ajahn Amaro, this is me, or you know, these are my robes, my glass of water. Yeah. If we look at this, and then we use the practices of vipassana, insight meditation, to explore that. Well, if this is my body, what's the thing that does the owning? What's the me that is the agent of owning? What does that me look like? Is it a man? Is it a person? Is it a human? Does it have an age, a form, a shape, a color, a size? What is it? Is it? And the process of insight meditation, that clear seeing, it breaks up those habits of I-making and mind-making, ahankara, mamankara. It sees, oh, there wasn't really a me who's the owner of this body. There's not really an I who is the owner of this life, this mind. These things are perceived, this personality, this mind, these faculties, these feelings of liking, disliking, comfort, discomfort. But the development of insight of vipassana helps the mind to know that, you know, no thing can really ever be owned. There's no thing, no solid permanent thing that is there, and no thing that can really do any owning. It's just an appearance. It's just a seeming. That's just the way that things look. It's not the actuality. So when we talk about letting go of difficult mind states, intense mind states, or self-criticism, then it's important not to make those into the enemy, not to make them into a problem or some kind of invasive disease that I've got to get rid of this. If I could just get rid of these negative thoughts, then I would be happy. Yeah. I've got a problem with self-criticism. I've got a self-hatred problem. I'm a depressive type. I have depression. So, well, yes, that's one way of speaking, but it's more skillful to say there's the experience of depressive mind states that arise from time to time, maybe very often. But It's to say I am is a presumption. It's adding on to it the picture, something that's not really there. And again, this is a very, very regular theme of Longpo Somedo's teachings that I feel is extremely helpful to apply. And it's repeated over and over. And, you know, he said it over and over, and I quote him over and over. Because it makes such a huge difference to shift the view from me and my problems, me and my difficult mind states, me and my lust problem, or my fear problem, or my jealousy problem, or my laziness problem, my selfishness problem. Changing the view from me and my problem to here is the wisdom mind seeing the way things are. Here's the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. The faculty of awakened awareness, knowing, seeing the way things are, here and now. We can say, I'm listening to this Dhamma talk, or I'm giving this Dhamma talk. You know? And on one level, yeah, that's true. But if we dig a little deeper below that surface level of perceptions, then in this moment, in this very moment, there is the faculty of knowing, aware of hearing, feeling, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. There's patterns of experience arising, taking shape, dissolving. There isn't a person there, really. We can say there's lots of people here in the temple this evening. But we can also say there are no people here, really. There are conditioned formations. We're all breathing in, breathing out. Just this afternoon with this beautiful winter sunlight coming through the windows of my kuti, you can see all these dust motes floating in the sunbeam. And you realize, when that happens, you realize, oh, this dust is floating around in the air all the time. It's just, I can only see it when the sun is shining through it in a certain way. But it's floating around all the time, and I'm breathing it in all the time. And actually, most of that dust is my skin. It's my old skin cells floating around in the air. It's me flying in the space of the room. So, this is a frequent theme for reflection. So we've been here in the temple. It's now 9:27. So we've been here for a couple of hours. So we've all been breathing in and breathing out, even though we haven't got sunbeams coming through the windows to see the dust motes. We've been breathing in those dust motes, breathing in those skin cells of each other for the last couple of hours. So this is community. We are sharing a body, or just the oxygen and carbon dioxide. We breathe out carbon dioxide, and somebody else breathes it in. Most of the air is nitrogen. We're breathing it out, breathing it in. We're sharing these bodies with each other, and they don't sit still for a second. They never stop changing for a millisecond. And when we shift the view, it's something that has to be applied, like the image of the saw hanging up on a peg on the wall. If it sits on the wall, it's not a saw. It's just an objet d'art. It's just a visual object. To be a saw, you've got to pick it up, put it in your hand, and hold it in a certain way, and draw the serrated edge across the wood in a certain way. Then it's a saw. Otherwise, it's just a visual object. So we have to apply this. Our vision just doesn't change on its own. But if we make that effort to go, it's not just me and my problem, me me and my difficult personality, or me and my struggles, or it can, you know, at the other end of the scale, it can be me and my wonderful personality, me and how special I am, me and my pride, and how wonderful I am. If there's the shift of view, then here is the, in this very moment, as we're sitting here, is the wisdom mind, knowing sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thinking, remembering, imagining, arising, taking shape, dissolving. It's the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, the wisdom mind, awake to the way things are. And when that shift occurs, when that shift is made, then there's a freeing of the heart right there. This, whenever that's applied here in this mind, in this life, there's an immediate freeing of the heart. There's a, oh, ah, the life gets suddenly a lot more integrated, a lot more spacious, easeful. There's a quality of rightness. As long as there's a me trying to do something or get something or have an opinion about something, then there's a stressing, there's a tension in the heart. When that subject-object duality is let go of, when it's when that self-centered habit is dropped, there's an easefulness, a spaciousness, a rightness. In a way, dukkha is another word for that feeling of wrongness. So things shouldn't be quite this way. Just a little bit more of this, a little bit less of that. If it was only a bit different, then. When the view changes, when there's the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, the awake mind attuned, open to the way things are, then that wrongness disappears. There's a rightness instead. There's a sense of course, life is exactly this way. It's just like this. Oh, there's a comfort, an ease, a sense of orderliness, a belonging, if you like, that is known in the heart. So I encourage us to notice that, to take the trouble to change the view. Even when things are really, really kind of raging, the mind is really upset or really excited or really depressed or agitated, really crazy, then just to shift that view, to recognize, oh, this is really crazy, or this is intense, or this is exactly what I didn't want to happen. That's what this feels like. That's what this is. And in that moment of shifting the view, this is the awake mind, this is vichara, awakened awareness, knowing the world, lokavidu, knowing the world. And it's like this. Let that quality of rightness, that sense of orderliness, of integration, let that be known, let that be conscious. Even if the object is really weird, you know, you're hallucinating or you're in extreme pain, physical pain, or things are really complicated or awkward, there can still be that sense of balance, of integration, of orderliness, even with difficult perceptions, difficult situations, and things that on the ego level, on the personality level, the thinking mind goes, oh dear, what do I do? Oh, this is dreadful. Oh, how do I handle this? Oh, I can't stand this. Or, whoa, what's going on there? If it's appreciated from the from self-view, or seen in terms of self-view, then we get upset, we get entangled in that depression, we become threatened or obsessive. We get born into those particular states. But just with this change of view, if we take the trouble to apply that, then even if those difficult situations or moods and states, feelings are there, there's an attunement to the situation, there's an attunement, an ease with it, and we find ourselves able to respond. We do what can be done, or we leave alone what can't be changed, or we just leave things be that we can have no effect on. So I encourage us to reflect upon these particular teachings, and as you hear these words, maybe you think, yeah, that's right. Maybe you think that's a load of rubbish. Maybe if you do think, yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely, that's right on the mark. Great, good stuff. Then hearing it in a Dhamma talk, understanding it in a Dhamma talk and appreciating it in a Dhamma talk is one thing. That's the kind of understanding based on thinking, that Chintamaya. But then the real value of these teachings is that as soon as I stop talking and then we have the time to meditate and being with our mind through the flow of our days, then the real value is the application of that moment by moment, hour by hour, day by day, as those different mind states appear. To the real value is not just that sort of inspiring, yeah, that's right, feeling, even though that's important and useful in its own right. It's the application, moment by moment, to change the view. That's what really makes a difference in our lives. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.